They've watched Citizen Kane a combined 200 times. Elliot's first words were, "I personally thought the use of Dutch angles was derivative in the 400 blows." In Nathan's favorite historical figure is Fritz Lang. Now they're bringing that snootiness to you with Magellan's at the Movies.
Hello, and welcome back to Magellan's at the Movies podcast, the hub of the Magellan's at the Movies media empire. Other regions, other important regions to our empire include Magellan's at the Movies, the book, which is not very interesting. I would not recommend it. Magellan's at the Movies Twitch channel, where Nathan and I stream Bennett Foddy games. And
Gosh.
Of course, Magellan's at the Doovies. The Magellan's at the Movies branded duvet blanket, which I am legally obligated to say is not suitable for the elderly, the pre-adolescent, or the immunocompromised.
Wow. So, funny.
Thanks. I am the director of the Magellan's at the Movies media empire, Elliot Mogollyans. I've got with me the CEO, Nathan Mogollyans. Nathan, great to have you.
Yeah.
Nathan, there's a bunch of stuff happening right now. No one cares about it. The Oscars are happening.
Yep.
Yeah, a couple thousand people will watch it. I probably won't be one of them.
Wow. Okay.
So instead of talking about just random stuff, sometimes we like to ask each other questions just about movies, pop culture, that kind of thing. Because I'll tell you what, I got Star Wars on the brain right now.
Of course.
Because I watched a video about the Star Wars super fans, right? The people who build their lives around Star Wars. The people who have Star Wars themed weddings, where the minister is dressed. When Nathan had his wedding, Nathan was dressed as Palpatine. Was marrying Princess Leia for some reason. That's kind of weird. I think he forced Betsy to wear a Princess Leia costume. But yeah, anyway. So Nathan, you're the resident Star Wars fan here. And I just wanted to ask you a couple, sort of like run by a few things. Because I'll tell you right now, for me, this kind of thing, I have never been able, probably never will be able to get to this level. People crying at certain things. People founding their identity upon the Church of Star Wars.
I mean, in some cases, not to interrupt you, literally, right? The Church of Jediism,
right, of course,
is a real thing. Like, real people have not figuratively, but literally built a religion out of Star Wars. So you're correct in your assessment of the levels of extremes that this can be at. But yeah, continue.
Well, I was just going to say that I'm not even saying necessarily that I sit in judgment of these people. I am just way too in my own head for this kind of thing. I'm just too self-conscious to go full on fan. So I'm just gonna get into it here. Nathan, how would you react if I, for your birthday, I got you a cameo? Are you familiar with cameo?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So for people who don't know, it's this like online platform where you can pay people, celebrities, for bespoke video messages. So if you want Arnold Schwarzenegger to say, right, "Mike, get to the Joppa, Mike," you can pay him and he'll do that. I am assuming. I don't know if he's actually on there. But if I got you a birthday message from George Lucas from Cameo, and I sat you down, I opened my computer, and I was like, "Nathan, happy birthday." And George Lucas appears, and he's like, "All right, hey Nathan, a little uh, Little Ewok told me that it was your birthday, so I just wanted to say, you know, have a happy 27th, and may the Force, you know, may the Force be with you.
He doesn't sound like that.
He absolutely does. Would you, first of all, would you actually like it? And second of all, would you like it so much that you would just be in shambles?
I definitely wouldn't like it so much. I'd be in shambles.
Oh, okay.
And I guess I wouldn't... anything someone got me genuinely trying to make me happy on my birthday, I don't think I'd be like, that's so stupid. I would, if it was like you, I would afterwards be like, what possessed you to think I would, like, that would mean that much? I'd be surprised if George Lucas was on Cameo, because he seems like the kind of fella, he's, you know, he sold his franchise for billions of dollars, and the man doesn't ever have to do anything ever again, I'm pretty sure. I don't know why he'd be on Cameo making $50 a pop to say, it's like poetry, it rhymes, will you go to the prom with me, Jacob?
That was great. That was a really good joke, Nathan.
Thank you.
So that's interesting, because is there... I think that your problem, that most Star Wars fans at this point, George Lucas is kind of a separate entity for them. But okay, so we're in the same thing. I'm saying happy birthday. Yeah. And it's like Harrison Ford or Mark Hamill. Or like, who's your favorite Star Wars character?
Usually, I mean, this is niche, but I love Matthew Wood, who plays General Grievous. You know this. He plays General Grievous in every piece of media that General Grievous has ever had a voice in, which I think is really awesome, because he's not, like, an actual actor. He's just a sound engineer for Lucasfilm. So I love Matthew Wood. If I got a cameo from Matthew Wood, I'd be like, that's a cute novelty, and it shows that you know me pretty well. But I wouldn't, I don't think there's any celebrity that I'd be like really amazed to get a cameo, because it's kind of just like a glorified singing happy birthday, right? Where it's like a person you know, and so you're like, OMG, they're saying Mogolyans incorrectly. That's so cool. I don't know what else, like, if you got me like a sit down meet and greet with Christopher Nolan, I'd be like, that's sick. Please give me 4 months to prepare questions. So I, you know, or, you know, something like that. There's celebrities that I wouldn't begrudge meeting, but I don't think there's any celebrity I'd want a cameo from.
But so I'm saying, like, people who you would, I don't know, it would be like a religious experience for you. I should say, like, artists or people whose work you are a fan of. Not like if our departed grandfather sent you a message from beyond the veil. Obviously, that would be pretty affecting. But yeah, just anyone who you would be like, oh, I love you so much.
I don't know. And we talk about this sometimes in our family, that we talk about celebrities who... Maybe we don't talk about it that much, but sometimes I think about, like, who's a celebrity who I would cry if I heard that they had died, because it was like, oh, their work meant so much to me, and just who they, what they represented was so big. And I really don't, I can't think of any artist who I love to the point of being that emotionally affected by their passing. It would maybe change the way I interact with whatever art they do. Like, right now I'm getting really into Bob Dylan music, so if I saw that Bob Dylan died, I'd probably listen to his albums with a different sort of feeling, especially some of his albums that are talking about mortality and death. It would change the way I feel listening to those, but I don't know if just the news itself in isolation would cause me to be that emotionally affected.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it just goes back to the fundamental unreality of all this.
Sure.
Like, even if I met, Christopher Nolan, I would, of course, be excited.
Yeah.
And it is absolutely a story that I would tell all my friends about, all two of them. Yeah. It is a story that I would be really eager to share, but I wouldn't like go in there and be like, "Oh, Mr. Nolan, you changed my life," because he didn't.
Yeah.
And the thing about cameos, like that, I don't want to just dog on Cameo, but like that's just a few steps removed from just having an AI George Lucas talk to you, because an AI doesn't understand what it's saying, and George Lucas has no context for who you are or the impact that he's going to have on you. He's just like shouting into the void, "Happy birthday, Nathan."
Mm-hmm.
And he could be wishing a birthday to, what's the name of the guy who founded the KKK? Nathaniel.
Oh, good grief.
Green? Is that it?
I don't know that off the dome. Is it really Nathaniel Green?
I don't know. No, Nathaniel Green, he was a revolutionary. Nathaniel Green and the Mountain Boys.
Yeah.
Gosh, dang it. What the? See, now I just have to
Yeah, you gotta look it up.
KKK Wait. Founder.
This banter section is really a bit of a downer.
Nathan Bedford Forrest.
Of course.
Who didn't found it. He was the first Grand Wizard. Okay. That's really interesting to no one.
Yeah,
but there's no, like, so even if Matthew Wood was like, "Oh, hey, Nathan, happy birthday," and he did in the Grievous voice, and he personally did the sound editing so that it was the actual, like,
sounded
Grievous,
like Grievous
thing.
Yeah.
Like, ah. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. So there's more questions. This is already taking so much time. How about if you went to, what is it called? Galaxy's Edge?
Yes. Yeah. The theme park.
At Disney World, isn't it?
It's one of those.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, if you went to that, because that's like, that is like a pilgrimage site for these Star Wars super fans. And there's videos of people who go up to, this like full-scale model, life-size model of the Millennium Falcon, and are just moved to tears. They build their own lightsaber, pay like probably $1,000 for the thing, to keep it. If you went there and did the whole thing, I think there's like a ride where you can sort of control a ship or something like that. Would that, how excited would you be for that?
I mean, that'd be, if someone else was footing the bill, I'd be pretty excited. But I also, what I'm kind of thinking here is, for a lot of big fandoms, what the property means to people is something different. Like I was talking with, like you said, right, with Christopher Nolan, where you're like, you wouldn't go up to him and say, "You changed my life," because you didn't. He didn't, right? He made movies that you really enjoy. And I think for some people, sometimes it did genuinely change their life, right? Like, people could be in a really bad spot and then watch a Star Wars movie and they feel a lot better because the way something was said in it did genuinely change their life. Like, I'll do an example for myself that maybe reveals too much about me, but like, I go to church pretty regularly and I find myself moved in church quite regularly, and it's not super uncommon that I'm moved to tears in church. And I think there's definitely some people who would be like, "That's so silly and ridiculous," but it's because, right, it means something to me. Like, it has affected my life in a way that the reminder of it, or these sorts of pilgrimages, like you said, or things that you can do that remind you of this thing that changed your life, can be very emotionally powerful. And I don't think there's any media property for me that has meant that much. Like, I love Star Wars, and any Star Wars thing I think I would enjoy doing. I remember going to see that concert had some of the, like, props and stuff, and that was a lot of fun.
Anthony Daniels was there.
Was he really?
Yeah, you don't remember that?
No, I can't.
He even did the whole odds thing. You don't remember that?
That's so... I hate my memory. Why don't I remember that? I love Star Wars. Like, I'm a huge Star Wars fan. And for some reason, the only... Like, the biggest thing I remember from that was seeing the, like, behind-the-scenes sort of thing of Palpatine shooting lightning at Yoda, where it's just, like, Ian McDiarmid making hands at nothing, where I was like, dang, yeah, that's so silly. So maybe that just destroyed everything for me. And so then I was like, Anthony Daniels, who cares? That's crazy.
Well, also, you were pretty young, so... I mean, I was pretty young, so...
This is what's annoying about this. There's so many times that you share a story on the podcast. I'm like, I'm older than you. Why don't I remember this?
Well, things stick in my memory. I don't know why. I don't like it, even. I remember a lot of bad stuff that I wish I could just forget. Yeah. But yeah, that is... I mean, again, like, if I would love one day to go to New Zealand for a lot of reasons, because it's a beautiful country. Yeah. But also, I would really like to go to Hobbiton, the old set. But I don't, I wouldn't like fall to my knees and be like, oh, this is it. This is like the birthplace of my, I don't know, spiritual awakening or anything like that. And it really does mean a lot to me, as do the movies. And I was thinking, like, there was a time in my life where I was not in a good place, and I played The Last of Us, the first game, a lot. I pretty much just exclusively played The Last of Us. Like, I would play through it, finish it, and then I would just restart it.
Yeah.
But see, even for stuff like that, like, I derive satisfaction and pleasure out of that. It was just a distraction. The last thing is LARPing. There are apparently, like, multi-day hundreds of people in attendance, multi-step games, essentially, that people do. And they do usually in, like, towns and cities, but you're, like, all over the place. You're running across town, across the city, talking to NPCs, basically inhabiting as much as you can. An original Star Wars adventure. Is that okay? Is that something? Because again, like, I am just frankly respect to that level of devotion, because I am just way too in my own head for that. Maybe that's why I could never be a great actor. Because I just can't lose myself to the even if I was in full getup, talking in, I don't know, Huttese or something, in the back of my mind, I would still always be sort of observing myself and going like, this is all, I mean, I'm still here. This is me, Elliot, real person, observing all of this fantasy. Is that something that you would do? Would you derive any satisfaction out of that?
I think I'm very similarly to you. I think I'm way too in my head about things like that. And I have too much of a voice inside of me being like, this is kind of silly. I can't really get super into stuff like that. Because it just... For me, it involves too much of, getting out of my own way, which I just am incapable of doing. Even at times, this podcast is like an example of that, where I have to be like, this is a little silly. But then, you know, I also really have a lot of fun with it, so it doesn't matter. So maybe I would have a lot of fun with it and discover that, you know, kind of like Dungeons and Dragons, that I don't really think I could do that very seriously, just because the idea of it is inherently silly to me. But maybe if I really put my heart and soul into it, it would, you know, turn out differently. But I don't know.
The final question, and I didn't even plan on asking this question. It's just that as we've been talking about this, we've consistently fallen back on it really depends on achieving this level of devotion. Really depends on what the franchise, a franchise, means to you and what parts of it mean the most to you. Because like we said, George Lucas, I don't think he would really do it for a lot of Star Wars fans these days. But Mark Hamill?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Ewan McGregor? Mm-hmm. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
So then I guess my question is then, what does Star Wars mean to you?
I think it's just a property I love. And I every time I come back to it, I have so much fun returning in any sort of way. When I watch a show, when I watch a movie, when I read a book, it's just a lot of fun, and it's kind of a joyful experience for me. I'm very excited for not so much The Mandalorian and Grogu that's coming out this year, but the Ryan Gosling movie, Starfighter, or I think that's the title, I'm very excited for. I think it could be a movie that's really good, which is a primary thing, but also really fun and maybe hopefully represent a new sort of direction for this Disney Star Wars. But yeah, it doesn't, it's not like, I watched it as a kid and I really loved it, but I don't think there was any moment where it meant something more than just a thing I watched that I really enjoyed.
Well, fair enough. But now that we've hopefully people found that engaging or interesting, and if not, hopefully they just skipped it. But now, by the way, Magellan's at the Movies, we are, of course, on Cameo. For $1,000, you can get a nice message from us, or one of us.
So definitely
check that out. But anyway, let's move on. Let's talk movies for once, at long last. Goodness. Nathan, today we are reviewing another titan of literature here. Because let me tell you, and for everyone out there, for people who may not know where the things that they like come from, let me tell you, before I'm Thinking of Ending Things, before If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, before Barton Fink, there was Franz Kafka.
Yeah.
So all of these stories, all three of those stories that I just mentioned, are Kafka-esque.
Yeah.
They are these often very surreal stories about people caught in complex situations that they don't understand, that they have no real way out of, whose rules are exceedingly obscure. And who are, haunted, I guess I'd say, by just a hint of the maybe supernatural. Certainly unnatural. That is Franz Kafka.
Sure.
Franz Kafka, I like him. I think he's a great author. He's dead now, so was a great author. In fact, he's so dead that I think his work is now in the public domain. But yeah, we are reviewing an adaptation of The Trial. This is an adaptation directed by Orson Welles, famed in song and story. Released in 1962. Well received, especially in the long run. I think it's kind of built up a reputation for itself. I have read this book. I really like it. In fact, I'll say, hot literary take incoming. I think it's better than The Metamorphosis. But yeah, so that's what we're doing. We're talking Franz Kafka, we're talking Orson Welles, we're talking The Trial. Nathan, let me know, what's your experience with, opinion of Franz Kafka, this book, and then give us your opening thoughts on the movie.
Yeah, I've read The Trial as well. I have a collection of short stories by Kafka that I think I got at like a book sale somewhere. That I really enjoyed includes The Metamorphosis. I don't know which one I'd say is better. It does include one story that I think is really great about a punishment machine or something in a prison, something like that. But yeah, I enjoy Kafka. I think he's I enjoy listening to you try to define what Kafka-esque is, because I think so many people have different opinions on what is uniquely interesting or creative about the stories that Kafka would tell. I mean, certainly if you're thinking, you know, supernatural, The Metamorphosis is distinctly supernatural. What happens has no obvious natural explanation. But different people pull different things from Kafka and highlight different things as being uniquely Kafka-esque. And so I think adaptations of his work then are really interesting because you get someone pulling a specific thing. And Orson Welles, I'm a huge Orson Welles fan. We reviewed Citizen Kane. I am a huge Citizen Kane. I don't want to say apologist because I think lots of people think it's really good, but certainly in my generation, it's become cool and hip to say Citizen Kane ain't all that. That's 100% false. It is all that. And Orson Welles...
And a bag of chips.
Yeah, it's all that and a bag of chips. And Orson Welles, Pauline Kael, I'm talking to you, is also all that and a bag of chips. The man's a genius. There's a reason why he's like every director's favorite director. And so I'm always down to watch another Orson Welles movie. This is one I hadn't caught yet. So yeah, very interested to dive into this, both from a Kafka standpoint and an Orson Welles standpoint. And just, you know, all the other stuff. But those are the two things that I'm most excited to sort of talk about.
All right. Well, you were supposed to also give your initial thoughts, but that's fine. Nathan's out of control. He's going off program.
I'm trying.
I guess then I'll start.
Yeah.
By saying I have no strong opinions about Orson Welles. I like Citizen Kane. But I feel like I am most familiar with Orson Welles, frankly, due to all the cameos that he's done in movies like Moby Dick and A Man for All Seasons.
The Muppets.
Yeah. Gosh, I forgot about that. I love that. I love the Muppets movie so much. So I'm just going to come right out and say it. I found this to be a little disappointing because... Like I said, I really enjoyed the book. As I was reading it, I was just imagining in my mind, I was like, oh, this is prime material for a cinematic adaptation. I could see it in my head.
Yeah.
And because it's in the public domain, Nathan, what are we doing? We should get some money up and make an adaptation ourselves. We can direct and star in it. We can both play the entire cast between us.
Can we?
Yeah, we'll have to do some creative editing, but anyway, I found it to be kind of boring at times, and I think I was thinking a lot. I watched this on Tuesday, and since then I've been thinking a lot about why did I not click with this, and I think when. A lot of the stuff that I feel about the movie, you could absolutely say about the book, that it's disjointed. Famously, this book, can you hear that, Foley? This book, I've got it right here. This book was a collection of chapters. The chapters were not numbered. So Kafka's friend, the person who published his novels posthumously, had to make some executive decisions on what went where.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that in the book, the thing that really keeps it hanging together is something that I think was almost completely lost in translation from page to screen, and that is the interiority of the main character, Joseph K. That in the book, because it's a book, we are privy to a lot of information about him, how he's thinking, how he's feeling, why he's doing the things that he does. We don't get that in the movie. So in the movie, despite it being a very faithful adaptation, Joseph K. feels like a non-entity in his own movie. Mm. And he's just this kind of blank spot that's kind of drifting through the film. I'm really struggling to connect with him. I'm really struggling to understand his motivations, because all of that work that the book can do by just saying Joseph went here because of this reason, this is the stuff that he was feeling. There's not necessarily an easy way to bring that to the screen, and it kind of feels like they didn't really try.
Mm.
So there's definitely stuff to like about it. I liked Anthony Perkins a lot. I liked Orson Welles a lot playing the advocate. Yeah. I enjoyed the set design. That's one of the things this movie is most well known for. And I liked the directing, but ultimately, all of that is definitely important, but in my opinion, it is secondary to the story, and the story, the characters, the writing, I just couldn't get into.
Interesting. I think it sounds to me like I'm a little more positive on the movie, and maybe to streamline some of this, since we spent 20 minutes talking about Star Wars.
Time well spent.
I actually thought it was interesting how much more of a character Joseph felt like in the movie. Read the book.
Gosh. I'm going to have to tussle.
I read the book a while ago, so my recollection of it is a little hazy. But as I watched the movie and then afterwards, as I was reading sort of some reviews of the film, a lot of them pointed out that Joseph K. has a different feeling in the movie versus in the book. And this is kind of what I was saying with everyone finds a different thing about Kafka as
the Kafka-esque thing.
Yeah, the piece that is so crucial to his work. And this was very interesting because I don't know if reading the trial, I got the same sense as in the movie, where it seems as though Joseph K. is much more righteously indignant at the situation he's put in as compared to the book, where I think he kind of comes across as a little more hapless, that he's led from place to place in kind of the way that you were describing him in the movie. Whereas I felt like in the movie, he had much more of like, he went from place to place and was like really irritated the whole time. And so he had a very clear sense of like, I'm going to do this because I'm like annoyed at the situation in which I find myself in, that he's going to remove the advocate from his thing. He's in the big courtroom space and he starts doing this big long speech about, you know, this is wrong and they're going about this, it's a sham trial, and which I find funny because he has like no information about the trial, so he's just doing this on principle of like, well, if it's happening to me, it's a sham, like this is ridiculous. And so I actually found Joseph K. to be a slightly more interesting character than I remembered from the books, and I thought Anthony Perkins was fantastic. He does feel very Norman Bates in this. That's obviously, maybe not obviously, but I think that's probably his most famous role, and this is a very similar sort of, like, a lot of hand-wringing, a lot of nervous energy that occasionally comes out very dramatically. But I thought it was really good. I thought it was, again, for this version of Joseph K., who to me feels very annoyed and irritated by the things he's put upon, as opposed to, I think, other Kafka-esque movies like you were talking about, they're just kind of befuddled. And in this one, I think he gets really indignant, really fat. Like, even in the first scene, he's already getting irritated at the people and saying, hey, you can't touch those pictures. You can't steal my clothes. So I don't really agree with your sense of Joseph in the movie.
Well, Nathan, unfortunately, I read the book 2 weeks ago, so I can say your memory is very hazy because Joseph K. is exactly like that in the book.
Well, then they did a great job of translating it.
Whatever. Well, just listen here, and I'll prove you wrong. I think the scene at the courtroom, quote-unquote, is a perfect example of the lack of interiority when it comes to Joseph K. Because I went back and I reread this section, and these two sections in book and movie occupy the same amount of time, but in the book, we get all of this buildup of Joseph K. feeling annoyed, his growing indignation, his disgust at the trial, at the proceedings, at the way that things are happening. We don't get any of that in the movie because it's all internal. So in the movie, I thought this scene was a real clunker, frankly, because Joseph K. gets up onto the stage and launches into his speech, the same speech that he gives in the book. It's just in the movie, he does it completely at random. Like, there is no indication of why he is doing this. He is just suddenly seized by an irrepressible urge to get up onto the stage and launch into this tirade about the way that things are being done. And when he notices the badges on people's coats, again, I thought it was very clunky that he just... Because in the book, he just notices the badges and then mentions them. In the movie, he has to, like, verbally bring to the attention of the audience these badges. And it's not even something that I think would be that difficult to do without having an awkward line. You could just have a shot of someone wearing a badge and have him then react to it. But because... Again, because we are so outside of Joseph K. in this movie, and because the movie, in my view, is not really trying to do anything to bridge the gap between us, to me, it's just so flat because he just does it seemingly on a completely random whim.
Sure. I guess. I think... I mean, obviously, I don't agree. I think it's decently well communicated. And I think my other reason for not necessarily having this same problem is it's not like Joseph K. is that interesting of a character. I mean, every Kafka protagonist is basically the same. It's a person who's frustrated at the situation he's stuck in. It's not like they have a lot of complex backstory that's informing some meaningful character arc they're going on. No, all of the books, it's spoiler for every Kafka book, they're just annoyed by the situation and then they die. Like, this, how, I guess the two famous ones that I've read go. I haven't read The Castle. I don't think that is an ending, so it doesn't count. We don't know that he wasn't going to kill the protagonist. But I think that's what also contributes to me being like, well, we don't get a lot of interiority of Joseph K. And I'm kind of like, you know, what's there to know? The whole fun of it is seeing him go through these silly hoops and be frustrated at the situation. For me, at least.
I mean, it's not that he's terribly interesting. It's just that he's not compelling without the interiority. That there's nothing really to ground me in this character because it seems like he's just turning on a dime from hapless and put upon and frustrated to indignant and righteous and speech-giving. Mm. And let me see. Once again, I've taken notes. This is the maturing that I've done.
That's huge.
Oh my gosh, my handwriting's terrible. Yeah, and as far as, like, as far as the internal logic of the story goes, another thing that I noted down is in the movie, Joseph K. is at an opera. I don't know why. Timothy Chalamet would be horrified.
Oh, no.
And he gets the inspector, like, summons him out and gives him a court summons. And so he goes to he summons him to the place where he goes and gives this speech. It's supposed to be an interrogation. So he goes there and he gives the speech. And then later in the movie, he goes back there. We do not know why he's going back there in the movie. We know in the book. Because in the book, he is summoned to the place, I think, on like a Sunday. And he doesn't really know when the time is. So he ends up getting there late. And then he thinks, well, I bet it happens at that time every week, every Sunday. So that's why he goes back. Again, in the movie, he seemingly goes back at random. We don't know why he's going back, what he expects to find. So to me, I found it way less impactful in the movie when he goes back there and the room is empty, because I'm not sure. I have no sense that that's not supposed to happen, or that he doesn't think that that's supposed to happen. In the book, we're much more grounded in what he thinks is going to happen. So for me, I am a lot more sort of with him when these things don't happen, when he's his confusion is a lot more impactful because I'm taking the journey with him rather than in the movie where he's just confused, and I'm like, well, why are you confused? Why did you think this was going to be different?
Hmm. I thought he did mention in that scene something about thinking that it happened every week or something. I thought he had mentioned something.
If he did, that would suck, because that would mean I just missed it. I don't think he did, but it doesn't matter.
I think you're kind of right that there is maybe less of a sense of... I think it's a Christopher Nolan quote about, you know, the different ways you can think about watching a character, and one of them being watching a character in a maze and one of them being the character in the maze. And I think some of the fun of the trial is being the character in the maze. And I do think this movie has a bit more of a sense of watching a character in a maze. But this is where, again, I had a lot of fun with it. And this is where maybe I'll pivot away from talking about the Kafkaesque of it all and Joseph as a protagonist. I think this movie is so well made. You mentioned that people talk about the production design. That's deserved. The production design is so great and fun. There's so many scenes in here that are just a lot of fun to watch. And I mean, 1960s, Orson Welles, the man wasn't being given bucket loads of money to make these movies, so it's a lot of fun for me to watch these and be like, dang, you know, where'd he shoot this? Where'd he do this to get this to look this way? The scene where Joseph returns home and his kind of neighbor's friend, sister, I can't remember what her relation to the roommate or the neighbor was, but she's dragging this box, and it's all, there's like a oneer that's all done in a wide shot of him talking to her and trying to help her and trying to figure out where his neighbor's gone, and it just looks amazing. I don't understand how it all looks so great. And then the visit to the painter is fantastic with this great lighting and all of these shadows and slits of light coming through all the different panels of wood and stuff, and the Joseph's office, which is just 50 people banging on typewriters all dang day, And the sound design is great, that every time they're in the room, you can barely hear anything because everything's typing. So the movie, I agree, it's a bit more of, let's watch this rat run around in a maze and see if he can find some cheese. This is the best looking maze I've ever seen. Maybe not ever seen. I don't want to be a little too superlative, but the movie looks really good, and it was a lot of fun for me to watch it.
Yeah, see, we're running up against the fundamental differences between us, that I do agree that the movie looks great and that the set design is fantastic. That just doesn't carry me in the same way that it does Nathan. But I do want to give special shout out to the set designers, and especially to, in the book, it's a bank. I have no idea what it is in the movie, wherever Joseph works. Because, it's just this massive open space. It looks like an empty warehouse that somebody has just put a bunch of hanging lights, desks, and typewriters in. And there's no offices or cubicles or anything like that. It's just this enormous open space. Did I already say open space? I'm repeating myself.
Maybe. I don't know.
It's just this enormous group of people writing on typewriters endlessly. Who knows what they're writing? And that is, again, one of the key components of the Kafkaesque, or maybe it's not, and I'm the only one who thinks this, and everyone else is like, oh, what are you talking about? That's not Kafkaesque. But to me, one of the key elements is the sense of alienation, defamiliarization, taking things that are slightly resemble things in your real world, like an office space, and tweaking them subtly or overtly, extensively, to make them just bizarre. And there's a lot of that. There's a lot of architecture that doesn't make sense. It's kind of like the Overlook in The Shining, how there's halls and windows that aren't really where they're supposed to be, or that if you think about the spatial logic of what you're being shown, there are doors that ostensibly lead nowhere and hallways that shouldn't exist. And they're like, when they're in the law offices, I think it's when he's going to see, he's moving around in the law offices, I can't remember why, and he like goes across a roof and then ends up in a train station or something. Like it's all very dreamlike, very surreal. And it's definitely contributing a lot more to my investment than Joseph K. Although I do have to say, if Joseph K was more of a character in this movie, I would probably find it even more compelling, because as it is, I'm just sort of appreciating this from a technical point of view. I'm not really in the movie. I'm not like imagining myself, I'm not on the journey with him, so I'm not thinking like, oh man, that I think if I was like in it, I would find it disorienting and a little frightening. Because I've said before how I just have this thing about being lost that scares me.
Yeah.
So to truly inhabit the movie, I think it would have enhanced everything. I mean, when does it not? When does truly being in a movie, inhabiting a movie, when is it like, oh man, this sucks? My experience is so much worse.
Yeah, I guess I just, this isn't surprising, I think, if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, is that I think movies as a visual medium need like a minimum of story for me to get invested, because it's not all about the visuals, but a big part for me is the visuals. And yeah, I just think it's great. I was kind of reminded, I really liked the joke where, I don't know if it's a joke, but one of the characters tells Joseph, like, oh, your uncle's waiting in your office. And then Joseph goes to his office, which is just like a desk on a platform that everyone can see. Clearly not an office. And his uncle is waiting there. I thought that was kind of funny. But yeah, I think the visuals of it make me disoriented by themselves. I also really like the visual of there's two times where people are walking towards Kay through like a cramped space. There's the is it the law officer who's like coming at him through like a
the student.
Yes. What's it called? A walkway? A catwalk. He's coming at him through a catwalk and he's having to crouch. And then there's the other time a person walks through like a bunch of weird boards. And just visually, I love the way it looks. And even little stuff like in the very first scene of the movie where the law officer, the policemen are meeting Joseph in his bedroom. I just, there's something I like about how low the camera is, that you can see so much of the roof, which makes it feel very claustrophobic and just kind of uncomfortable. That it, you know, already in just the first moments of the movie, I am just getting this sense of being trapped, of being constrained, of being put upon just by the environment, not by any person, but by the four square walls I'm living in. And I just think there's so much visual storytelling in the movie. There's even, near the end of the movie, there's a Dutch angle that I don't hate, which is insanely rare. But when he leaves the painter's thing and he's holding the two paintings, I'm pretty sure there's a bit of a Dutch angle to the shot. And I was just like, dang, he's really, it makes sense. Like, he's really out of sorts. Like, there's no good reason he should be in the law offices. When he turns around, he's like, hey, that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't. It's great. And so I love it. Obviously, I've yammered on now about the visuals of it all.
Yeah, I mean, I can't disagree. It's just, for me, if I wanted to just see moving images with no emotional context, I would frankly be on LSD or something. Or I would look at a painting.
Wow. You're not moved by paintings?
Huh?
You're not moved by paintings?
I am moved by paintings. Oh, I was okay. Just looking at... Oh, I'm not going to get into this with you. Yeah, so... Gosh, there's not... I mean, the movie is very... I wouldn't say it's stripped back. But there... It's very... I wouldn't even say that it's focused, but it's what would I say about it?
It's,
now that we've established what I wouldn't say.
I mean, it's kind of a simple movie, well,
it's,
right?
It's compact.
Yeah.
I thought maybe I was just like too enamored with the movie version of the trial that I had filmed in my head to be invested in the actual movie that somebody made.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just going to say, it's funny how one of the last scenes of the movie and one of the last scenes of the book, or one of the scenes in the chapter that the guy put last,
mm-hmm,
is in the church with the priest, where I keep on wanting to call Joseph K. Kafka. It's because his name starts with a K.
Yeah.
Where Joseph K., I mean, look, Joseph K., he's got all these women throwing themselves at him. Might be a little bit of a self-insert from Kafka there. No, when he goes to the cathedral, and it's a great scene that, again, I think in a different movie would have been really impactful because... He's finding it really hard to get around, and the architecture of the church doesn't make sense, and he has this encounter with the priest, and the priest is somehow part of the legal system.
Mm-hmm.
And so he actually tells Joseph K. the story about the man who tries to enter the law. But most of that is given to the advocate, who's played by Orson Welles. Wonder why that might be. I enjoyed all the side characters here. I think that they serve their purpose to be weird. Yeah. And I like, look, Orson Welles, interesting guy, good actor. I think he's a good actor. when he's trying, which is not always. But here I do think that he's trying, and I really like the scene where his other client, where Joseph K. tries to get rid of the advocate, again, seemingly at random in the movie, not in the book, just going to say it. And the other client comes in, and the advocate is just so hostile to him, is demonstrating to Joseph K. how lucky he is to sort of have an in with the advocate when usually he treats his clients like dogs. Again, why would Orson Welles put himself in this position? I don't know. It's a complete mystery to me. But he does somehow manage to inhabit the character of a man with substantial ego dominating the people around him. And I would say the same goes for the nurse, Lenny. I mean, she's just really weird. She's so lustful for Joseph K. I don't know why, but it works. It again, it contributes to that sense of just something being off, something weird.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a very, it's a movie with one goal in mind, and it's not concerning itself with a lot of else. So there is a limit to how much you can talk about it, because there's like the main character, there's the bare bones of the story, and there's the technical elements. I guess that's true of any movie, but it's not like Lord of the Rings, where there's like 8 different characters you can dive into their character arcs and what's happening to them and how it impacts you emotionally. But yeah, I like all of the side characters. I'm a big Orson Welles fan. I think in the right roles, Orson Welles is just fantastic. I think this is an example. It's anyone, yeah, kind of like you said, who's just a bit of a megalomaniac, except for Chimes at Midnight. Chimes at Midnight, he plays decidedly not a megalomaniac, and he does it really well. It's very against sort of type, I guess. And then, of course, his final role, as I'm pretty sure he voices Megatron or something in the Transformers movie.
Not Megatron, Unicron.
Oh, Unicron, of course. Isn't that like the god of the Transformers? I'm not up on my Transformers lore.
It's like it's like Ego.
Okay.
The planet. It's like a living planet. Yeah. And of course, it can transform from a planet into just a really large man.
Sick. Anyway, yeah, I like all the side characters, and I think it's interesting. I think it's certainly a movie that, kind of like the books, you can make it about anything, right? It's about religion, it's about society, it's about the literal legal system. It's vague enough that you can fill in kind of whatever you want. Who knows what Kafka meant for it to mean? I don't even think he meant for it to be released, so... what can be done about that?
I bet he just meant like, oh man, women love me.
I'd like to think he, just all of his books, the final idea was just, wouldn't that be crazy? What if you woke up and you were a bug, bro? Wouldn't that be nuts?
That would be nuts. Wow, what the heck?
What would I do? What if my family hated me as a bug? Would you love me if I was a bug? It's kind of the vibe of his books, not to...
Well, you know, I don't know if you do know this, actually.
Okay.
Franz Kafka, keep on giving him his full name. Kafka was I can't remember if he was a lawyer. He was definitely trained in the law. Like, he was familiar with the legal system.
Interesting. So maybe it is the legal system.
I don't know. I was going to ask you about if you had, like, a bespoke interpretation of it. I agree, it's definitely open to interpretation. When I read the book, I was thinking like, oh, it's kind of like about how made up it all is.
Oh, sure.
That the law is a complete figment of human invention. So all of these rules, all of these complex overlaying bureaucracies, and I think the law in general, right, the law, the royal law, is a perfect what, target setting for a story like this, because there are all these rules and exceptions, mm-hmm. and you need like years of training to understand it all. There's books upon books upon books of just like case law, of just stuff that has happened. And that's kind of the sense that I was getting from it. That like there's no real reason for it. Like Joseph K. is always wondering why this is happening to him, and on a metaphysical level, that question has a lot of answers, but on a purely mechanical level, in terms of the mechanics of his situation, there is no reason for it, no like hard physical reason for it, because of course this is all just stuff that we as people have kind of spun out for ourselves. But what did you think, if you thought anything, aside from, oh, it's pretty?
Well, I do think I got the sense, and a part of this was from reading other things, but I think there's definitely a sense in the movie of guilt, or at least you've come out of lockstep in something everyone else is seemingly lockstep in. Like, everyone else seems to have a better grasp on what's happening to Joseph than Joseph himself. And so just this sense of being an aberration where you can't put your finger on why you're the aberration, why you're the thing that everyone's, why you're the thing that's different and that everyone's put upon. And kind of like at the end, the advocate is giving this speech where he explains like, oh, all of the women like you because you're guilty. Like, you look guilty. And so people are attracted to you because of that. And that to me feels very much like this same thing of like, he looks guilty? What are you talking about? So he's just somehow innately guiltier than everyone else. So that was kind of what I felt, I suppose, watching it.
Well, he does say at the beginning, doesn't he say that like guilt is sort of in the mind, or innocence is in the mind? He says something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. The only other note I have before we can get into ratings is Orson Welles does the credits. He like talks.
Oh yeah, I thought that was really. I also really liked. I guess I sort of cut you off, so I don't know if you're going to say this, but I really liked him reading out the credits and saying, yes. "I played the advocate. My name is Orson Welles, and I directed."
Yeah. No, I love it. He does this in The Magnificent Ambersons, too. And it's just so, it makes more sense in that movie because it's kind of a cozy, fun movie. And so it ends with kind of a cozy, fun, I'm Orson Welles, I directed this movie, and here's everyone who did it. But I think it's cute that he did it for multiple movies. I got to watch, like, The Lady in Shanghai or something to see if he did that consistently. But I just think it's just the neatest. I wish everyone did this. Christopher Nolan would be there for, you know, years listing everyone who's in The Odyssey. I worked on this, and Robert Pattinson, and Zendaya, and Tom Holland. Yeah.
He should have done it for Transformers.
I don't think he directed
Optimus
that.
Prime was, I know, but just this, any movie that he's in. Yeah, Optimus Prime was voiced by, what is it, Peter?
If you know it.
Peter. Definitely Peter Cullen. Yes.
Okay. Wow.
Optimus Prime was played by Peter Cullen. Megatron was played by this guy. I played
Unicron.
My name is Orson Welles.
Thanks for watching. Anyway, let's get to ratings.
Buy Transformers at a store near you. That's what he should have said.
All right. This episode just ballooning up. It feels like we're trapped in a Kafka novel now. We can't finish the podcast.
Absolutely. Did you see the trailer for, I mean, I'm just fully embracing it. Did you see the trailer for, what is it, Passenger? I think it's like based on a creepypasta or something. Didn't see this.
We're letting them, it's based on anything now. Based on a dream I had.
Dude, creepypasta movies, they're big right now. Because I think there was one made with Sidney Sweeney.
What are you talking about?
Backrooms, obviously.
Yeah, of course, yeah. What?
The point is that I think it's about like people stuck on a highway. Mm. They like can't get out of the car. Maybe they can get out of the car. I don't know. I should abort this. I'm talking about something I don't really know all that much about.
It's like the exterminating angel. They can't
leave
the mansion.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Is that Kafkaesque? I don't know. Write in with your thoughts.
Is it Kafkaesque? That's a good question. I don't want to get too derailed. I think it is. Yeah. I'd say it's definitely, it feels like it's vaguely about society, and that to me is what's uniquely Kafkaesque, is it has to feel like it's vaguely about society. Anyway, rankings, this is an 8 out of 10 for me. I think it looks great. I think it's a little thin story-wise. I agree with you there, but come on now. Orson Welles, this man's, he's so good at making movies.
My rating, it's gonna be a C+. I mean, I don't think it's a, despite being a very faithful adaptation, I don't think it's a good adaptation. Struggled to get into the characters or the main character and all that kind of stuff. It looks nice. I mean, it's entertaining to watch. But yeah, it's not enough. That's not good enough.
All right. Well, I'm gonna go first. I'm assuming Elliot is going to recommend a movie that is Kafkaesque, and so I am recommending a movie that is not Kafkaesque. I'm recommending The Magnificent Ambersons I recommended Chimes at Midnight. I'm just recommending all of Orson Welles' filmography at this point. But I think if you enjoyed this because of how it looked and how it was made, The Magnificent Ambersons is Orson Welles' follow-up to Citizen Kane. It is a little not his vision. There's kind of the holy grail of film historians, as if they could find the original cut of The Magnificent Ambersons. If anyone has that, they're sitting on like a fortune. Anyone would pay a fortune for it. But the version we get is very good. It's a really fun story of this family changing through the years, but I don't even think Orson Welles is in it, except as the narrator, maybe. But it's just a really fun movie, incredibly well made. And yeah, I think if you're enjoying Orson, if you've seen this movie, you've probably seen The Magnificent Ambersons. But if you haven't, you should watch it. It's a lot of fun.
Okay, interesting. That's just like that's basically just a movie that you enjoy. It doesn't really have anything to do with the trial.
It's directed by Orson Welles.
Oh, good point. My recommendation, you're right, it is going to be a Kafka-esque movie. I actually mentioned it at the top because I'm going to recommend If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. Mm. This is a movie that came out last year.
Yeah.
And the reason I chose it is because it is, in my opinion, as we've said, Kafkaesque is sort of up for interpretation, like all of his work. But in my opinion, it is definitely Kafkaesque. It's certainly scratching that itch of just a put upon person lost in a situation that is constantly declining. Can't seem to get her fingers under it, with all these hints of just like weird, unnatural, surreal things. So it's about this woman who's trying to, with an unwell child, and she's trying to balance like a million different obligations to her child, to her husband, to her work, and all the while she just keeps on having these bizarre encounters with other people and with holes in ceilings. It's really good. I enjoy it a lot. If you like The Trial, the book or the movie, for that sense of defamiliarization, the sense of something being uncanny, and of watching a person just trapped in a bizarre situation, give it a watch.
Yeah, that's a good one. Rose Byrne up for an Oscar, I believe.
Is she?
Yeah, for Best Actress, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, yeah, we're going to be back next week. We'll probably
Hold on a second. Let me just say, in the trial of life, I judge it to be hard and full of disappointments. Great. And sentence it to, I don't know, 90 days probation.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to all of this.
Hopefully everyone enjoyed the Star Wars talk.
Yeah. We're going to be back next week. We'll be talking about another movie. We'll probably do some reactions to the Oscars if anything crazy happens there. If, like, Leonardo DiCaprio slaps Conan O'Brien or something, we'll
They probably do that as a bit.
Not an unfunny bit, not the funniest bit I could think of. But we'll be talking about that, be reviewing a movie. We hope you have a great week in between. Thank you so much for listening.